Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the podcast, Little Eyes, Little Ears, Centering Children and Youth in Gender-Based Violence Work. This podcast is from the Learning Network at the Center for Research and Education on Violence Against Women and Children at Western University. The purpose of this podcast is to enhance work to support children and youth in contexts of intimate partner violence. I'm Dr. Linda Baker, and I'm pleased to host today's episode with our amazing guest, Shaniqua Phillips. Shaniqua Phillips' passions are serving her community and creating constructive and accessible spaces for Black youth. In her previous role as a program manager for the Black Peer Education Network at Black Women in Motion, she oversaw the effective planning and implementation of the program. In connection to her work with Black Women in Motion, Shaniqua has worked several years within urban agriculture with an interest in environmentally sustainable practices and waste management. Her connection to her Dominican, also known as the Nature Isle, and Ghanaian, also known as home of Pan-Africanism roots, heavily influenced how she shows up in her work. Beyond work, Shaniqua enjoys traveling, creating, spending time with her family, and learning new things. Shaniqua, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're very interested in your work. We know you've been championing constructive and accessible spaces for Black youth. Will you just share a little bit more about yourself and your current work?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I have done youth work or was in youth work, specifically supporting Black youth for several years with Black Women Motion, as well as other agencies in the GTA and after school programs and stuff like that. And as well as my involvement with the York United Black Students Alliance at York University. And that's kind of like where it sparked for me at university, like the importance of having safe spaces and culturally relevant spaces and it being specific towards Black folks, because it made a difference in how people were able to engage with their university experience. It made a difference in how folks were able to know that they weren't the only one and remove that veil of isolation that folks can usually feel within their first couple years of university. And from there, I, you know, have been blessed to be able to be in other Black spaces that are doing similar work. And even when I'm not, I'm always making sure of like, how can we just make the space safe?
Your work in creating healthier and safer spaces, learning spaces, but all kinds of spaces, just spaces that are healthy and safe for Black youth. We know from that work that you'll be very familiar with how experiences of gender-based violence, such as sexual violence, can be particularly traumatic for any youth. But for Black youth, such harms can be further compounded. Can you speak more to this?
Usually when we're having these conversations with Black youth, we try to start from like the root of it, right? Where it began, where it came from, where some of these racist ideologies that kind of have had a play in justifying violence towards Black folks, and how that shows up now and how it's implicated now, right? Through our workshops, one in particular, like our rape culture and media literacy workshop, we really tried to talk about the colonial history of gender-based violence and how through chattel slavery, through different aspects of racism in history, sexual violence is justified towards Black folks, right? In terms of Black folks being over-sexualized in a particular way, and seen as objects, right? Literally at some point, three-fifths human. So if someone is experiencing that violence, but is not a human, how exactly are we going to be able to validate what they're experiencing? How exactly are we going to believe them? That's where a lot of that comes from, right? Like that root is in colonialism. So we talk about pre as well, right? Pre-colonialism, pre-slavery. What were societies like? What did they exist like? And then talk about and to contrast what it was after that fact, right? And just the biological determinism that exists within colonialism, again, that justified the violence towards Black folks. So a lot of people don't know that history, right? I think, especially in the context of Canada, it's only of recently, within the last few years, that Black history has been pushed in a particular kind of way to understand the expanse of it, not just the Harriet Tubman coming here for freedom, but that there are some folks that came here and went back to the North because of the violences that they experienced here, as well as the fact that slavery was here as well, right? That Canada also has a colonial history of racial violence towards Black folks. So when we're understanding that, then we can put to sense the systemic and institutional racism and violence that is experienced, and why there may be stereotyping and prejudgments when it comes to accessing support, and not receiving support, and just simply not being believed. Like, one of the core things that that Black Women in Motion strives on is believing survivors and believing Black survivors. And that alone is such a powerful statement, because we've seen with this workshop, and even in contrasting it with what happens in the media, there are several situations that have happened towards Black folks where they've experienced gender-based violence or sexual violence. And we've seen how those are treated versus other sorts of violences. How, when we're applying intersectionality, the different levels of how one individual can experience life, we use the term intersectionality throughout what we're doing a lot, which is a term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a Black lawyer from the States, a Black woman. That talks about just the varying ways that an individual can experience discrimination or violences from the system, from their identity, whether it's your ability, whether it's based off your ability, your access, your finances, your race, your class, your gender. Even, you know, in context of how we discuss things, talking about colorism, shadism, all of these things play a factor as to how you'll be believed, how you'll get access, how you won't get access. That is normally how we would engage with these kind of conversations with the youth, and to make sure that we have a level of contrast and have a comparison to show them what exactly they're feeling, right? What exactly is happening. And that also allows for validation in those moments.
It's right. I'm curious, you mentioned, Shaniqua, that for many young women, they have not had the opportunity to learn about the history that you're sharing in these workshops with them. And I'm just wondering what that is like, if you can help us understand a bit. Is it, what do you see in terms when they become familiar with that history and the oppressions and the resistance? What kind of reaction do young people have?
Well, I would say that, I mean, it's, I would say that when you're learning these things, the reaction initially, even for myself personally, when I was learning, for other folks that I've heard, is the validation of knowing that, like, you, what you're feeling is not coming from anywhere. That, like, when you're going into a space and someone is treating you differently or not treating you the same as someone else, that there's a reason for that, that there is institutional and systemic racism that exists, and the bias that comes with that, the result is not getting the same level of access, the same level of attention, the same level of information as other people that are from different racialized backgrounds or from you know, the like majority. It's important to do that when working with survivors. Validating and affirming and letting folks know that they're not too far from the mark as to what they're, you know, feeling inside. And when you're learning these things and those things connect, then it helps with building a trust with yourself, like rebuilding that trust with yourself, and trust generally that may have been lost in, you know, past experiences of harm.
And the barriers that you're talking about in terms of it, not just, I mean, the most fundamental being belief, but in accessing supports, that how are we doing with that? Are we making progress? And I think that things like Me Too, the move Me Too, and other things that have had a lot of publicity have helped with that, but are we doing enough in terms of education, in terms of changing the colonial kinds of messages that have been imparted, and the messages that the actual history that has not been shared?
So I would have to commend, you know, the Black leaders that have been doing the work when it comes to recognizing gender-based violence and sexual violence amongst the Black community, because if it weren't for marginalized folks stepping up and speaking out about the violences and injustices that they were facing, then this work would not exist, right? And the city, you know, we can commend lots of Black professors, lots of Black community leaders, community members, as well, and advocates and activists that have just made a lot of noise about injustices they experience, right? So I think it would be a point to listen to those folks, right? Put our ear to the ground and hear what those folks are doing, have been doing in supporting their community, right? Black Women in Motion is a grassroots organization. It's been in existence for almost, if not a decade now. And it has remained a grassroots organization to continue to do the work that it has been doing, right? That some people are doing these things, taking a step back from whatever personal gain they can get to intentionally make an impact on their community, whether that be small or large. So I think it would be important for the government, for organizations to contact people who can support them with doing consultations on whether or not they're supporting survivors accordingly, whether or not they are. Whether or not they are doing the necessary work in supporting survivors, as well as confronting potential biases and judgments that they might have had that either they have known about and they're just sitting in it, or they may not have known about because they may not have had to engage with it. And there's obviously an open space in terms of learning, but we have to be prepared also to be called in terms of what we're not doing. Called in and called out in terms of what we're not doing. But again, I would really stress, you know, recognizing, reaching out, and acknowledging the Black leaders that have been doing the work, right? For the past few years, we wouldn't have had a lot of the advancements if Black folks didn't make noise. We're making that noise generally, but it comes off the back of someone who had to lose their life to recognize how badly institutional violence is, or how badly systemic violence is, how bad systemic violence is, right? When we think about Sandra Bland, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and these folks have experienced these different levels of violence, and we made that noise, that's when people to listen. But we can't keep on, people who have the access and power cannot listen only when Black people die, because we're living and we're existing and we're breathing and we're doing this work and wanting to do this work to help people thrive and live and build legacy. And in order for us to do that, we need to be given that space and that understanding and that willingness to learn and unlearn the things that are harming why we are not being believed as survivors of violence. Why are we going into spaces and we're getting side-eyed when we're trying to get help, right? You know, and that Black, it's, we're not a monolith. Like, there are folks that are queer, folks who live with disabilities, all of these things within our Black community, right? And those folks who are in those spaces are still experiencing discrimination even within their intersections, right? So it's important to know that being a Black person with different intersections, having also experienced sexual violence, is so layered. And we have to constantly be learning and constantly be progressive in how we're addressing our entire communities and what they need.
You eloquently described the workshops that you would do through Black Women in Motion in terms of with young people, and how education in the sense of Black history, Black current oppressions and anti-Black racism, and the context that exists, and the importance of understanding that context in terms of their experience as a survivor of sexual violence or other forms of violence. I'm wondering, are there other strategies that you've used in your work in addition that you think were particularly supportive to Black youth in terms of their surviving violence?
Some of the ways that we try to make sure that we're staying relevant to the experiences of the youth that we're serving is by being unapologetic as to how the information that we're sharing and how we're doing that. Being unapologetic in terms of just how we're doing this work, right? Being very specific about the people that we're talking about, the experiences that we're acknowledging. Like, it is a thoroughly Black program, right? It's like Black and, I would say, because again, Black folks are not a monolith, right? So it's a thoroughly Black program. And we in ourselves, we're constantly learning, how do we address folks that live with disabilities? How do we address folks that have experiences of being a refugee? How we address experiences of folks that deal with substance abuse? How do we address folks that are part of the LGBTQ plus community? There was always room to learn and grow in understanding our Blackness, as well as how other people have lived in their lives as Black folks, and what would be the implications of violence onto someone who's living with varying levels of intersections, right? How would that impact their ability to gain the information that we have at some point, right? In terms of not having access to it. So in recognizing, you know, we're Black folks living in Canada, we know where the gaps are for ourselves, much less for the youth that we're working with. So recognizing also how folks who are experiencing mental illness or deal with, have issues surrounding mental health, how are we going to create a space where that is unique to where they are able to have those breaks when they need it, to break away from a capitalist structure of how work and things are and what is expected. How do we understand what type of, what is an unrealistic expectation of us with where we're at, recognizing, giving the room to recognize where we're at and say, okay, this is what I can do, right? Having the one-on-ones, having the check-ins, having just room to learn and grow as we were also learning and growing, because there are times where we have to check ourselves and be open about that. So it's just, when you're building community and stuff like that, you need trust, you need honesty, you need authenticity. You need to be able to feel and see, feel like you can be your whole self, but also see other folks being their whole selves, right? So we tried, like, I think when we talk about culture relevant programming, sometimes folks can treat it heavy-handedly and like...
In what sense?
It has heavy-handedly in terms of like it being maybe specifically African or specifically hip hop or specifically, you know, like being very specific as to like a particular aspect of Blackness when us as a community, again, not a monolith and so vast, right? It would be impossible for us to do it all, but it's a matter of like as a progressive organization, as a progressive folks doing this work, how are we going to do our best to make sure that everyone is feeling seen? How are we doing the intake to know who's coming in so that we're going back and tweaking workshops or tweaking information or, you know, changing terminologies that might be dated to make sure that folks are coming in feeling seen, right? But when you're working with Black youth, when you're working with youth, but particularly Black youth, I would encourage that you always go back to the drawing board. Like if your youth are telling you, oh, we don't like this, or, you know, this is not working for me or whatever, or an individual saying like, I don't have capacity, et cetera, there's no harm in going back to the drawing board. Like there's no, I think in doing this work and in life in general, what I've been trying to adapt is that you will fall, but like these are lessons. So how can we always learn from our lessons, like learn from those mistakes, learn from what may have worked, might not have worked. You know, we're making sure that we're intentional when it comes to our evaluations and going back and seeing like, how are folks, you know, receiving this, making sure, you know, we have an open door policy, making sure that we're remaining accountable to the things that we said we're going to do, right? To the best of our ability.
So youth voice becomes really important in terms of their feedback, in terms of, and you seek that out from them, and then that informs, as you go step by step.
Yeah, being heard, I think, for anyone is really important, but particularly when you experience certain levels of violence that could have been from your interpersonal space, right? What, or institutional space, or, you know, other systems, other spaces that you've gone through, when you're able to put words to what you're saying to a group and space of people who understand that, who understand firsthand or are at least willing and open to learn, it makes a huge difference on a person's self-esteem and what they feel like they're able to do in other spaces. Because for some people, they're coming in and they have a lot of knowledge and information. But for some people, this is a stepping stone or a breaking point for them to be able to make the necessary changes that they would want. Even for me as a staff, like there's so many waves and roller coasters that I've gone through in doing this work, you know, from sadness to rage to joy to, you know, in having to engage and defend certain things. Like, it's a lot.
When you talk about the power of this culturally relevant programming, and what are your thoughts? Can it be integrated into mainstream programming in other gender-based violence organizations?
I would say that yes. I mean, it just it would just need to be done intentionally. Like, that's the thing, is that when we saw these violences happen, like during the pandemic to Black folks, then we saw the ways in which I feel like we saw in real life, the ways in which people can take something like the advocacy of the work that people have done and that community activism and capitalize on it. Like, all these organizations and corporations donating money or putting in their, on their websites that we support Black Lives Matter, we support LGBTQ, et cetera, right? Great. But what are you doing now? Did that then. What are you doing now? It's 2023. Yeah. It's 3 years later. Have you still continued the work and supporting Black folks who've experienced gender-based violence? Are you still doing the work and supporting Black youth, Black LGBTQ youth, et cetera, that even who haven't experienced violence, that just need a space? Are you supporting the community on a whole with the messaging that the same messaging that you portrayed in 2020, right? So, and I think that can go for agencies and community organizations on a whole, that how are you applying the information that is very open and out there to the work that you're doing? If you know that there's a gap, how are you filling those gaps, right? How are we looking at the entire population of Canada, right? I think when it comes to Black folks and Indigenous folks and like people of color, sometimes there can be a veil and there, or there's a glass ceiling, right? But how are you, what are you doing to make sure that that glass ceiling doesn't exist and that it's open for folks to be able to come to your space and know that this is a safe space? How are you using the access that you have to make that change, and not just like a one-time thing, but if you really believe in supporting folks that have experienced extreme violence, what ways in your life are you continuously making efforts to do that, to change that? Some people might be able to do certain things surface level, but you'll eventually see in their work how, like, the gaps in terms of what they're doing. How are we making intentional steps, right, to ensure that we are serving all communities to the best of our ability? And if we're not doing it to the best of our ability, why aren't we doing it, right? We are a part of the Canadian population. Black folks are here. We've existed from the inception of Canada. We've existed, right? So what makes serving this particular community difficult outside of, you know, racism, outside of these different forms of oppression? What does that?
I want to go back for a minute, Shaniqua, to the Black youth, and they're engaged in resistance in their daily lives, whether they call it that or would describe it as that. They're resisting oppressions, resisting violence, including structural violence. Can you talk more with us about what that might look like and how we can support them in building resilience and their ongoing resistance.
We can support Black youth that are living and existing and resisting and all of that by just allowing them to also exist. I think sometimes there's an expectation that, you know, Black folks have to, you know, go above and beyond, work twice as hard. And sometimes Black folks just need a space, Black youth just need a space to exist, just to be. You know, I'm coming here to learn this thing and then I'm going to leave. Like, not everyone, like, you know, recognizing personalities, who's the overachiever, who's not. Like, seeing folks as a whole versus as their adversity. This person's coming to the to get the support that they need, but that doesn't mean they have to champion, you know, what it is that they're doing. There's some people that will definitely be able to do that, but there's other folks that are like just trying to get over this particular narrative and story that they've told themselves that might not be positive and move on from it, right? And I think allowing Black youth to exist as Black youth is support enough, you know, in terms of giving them jobs, making education accessible, having programs that encourage their interests, having accessible mental health resources, these different kind of things, just day by day, even when we're even thinking about food insecurity, a part of what we did in our programming is that while folks were in our programming, they received food boxes or gift cards every month as a part of our programming, because you can't learn if you're hungry.
No.
Can't learn, you know, it's hard. So
and we're talking basic needs.
Yeah, there's basic needs, right? Mm-hmm. There's basic needs that Black youth have that, you know, we need to support. And just getting to know where Black youth are generally, because not all Black youth are in the same place. Not all of them in their journeys. So it's just like, what do you need? Ask, you know, genuine questions. Again, and going back to like our process with Black Women Motion, we had check-ins, you know, every couple months or so just to see where folks are at. But we also, most importantly, had an open door policy that if folks needed additional support or additional check-in, additional time, that they knew they could come to us. Even after programming, if you've wanted any resources or information about stuff, it's like, sure, connect with us, we'll send that. There's nothing to that, right? Yeah, it's really important for Black youth to feel, you know, who are survivors in particular, people who've experienced violence, to feel seen, heard, and believed. I feel like those are the three things that can really help like their process, right? Whatever that is. Just feeling seen, heard, and believed. So just start there, you know, and just see people, their personalities, how they act, what makes them happy, what makes them sad, you know, and where people are in their day-to-day. Not, sometimes we would do check-ins where are we on 1 to 10, right? And some people would be at like 3, 4, some people would be at like 7, 8. But the most important thing is that everyone showed up. So that means there's some level of care for self,
yes.
Right? So it's just a matter of continuing that formula of making sure folks feel seen, heard, and believed. And
through community, through a sense of that group that came together.
Yeah.
And they showed up. There's a sense of belonging, a sense of connection that's happening in that program.
Yeah. And I think in addition to that, in specifically talking about survivors of gender-based violence, it's also autonomy. That, I think, is a huge component when in this particular work is how are folks able to take back their autonomy? How are we what are the things that we're doing to allow folks to know that they have autonomy over themselves, right? Because we're talking about a space where a lot of folks have had things taken from them, where space has been taken, violence has been impacted, like attention has been given that's not wanted, things have been said not wanting to, just ways people have challenged, their space. And one of the things I think is really important outside of being seen, heard, and believed is how are you, what structures do you have in place that allow this individual to build their autonomy back to themselves? I think that's really important when it comes to supporting survivors, particularly Black youth.
Really, that sense of agency. You've shared so much with us, and I'm just wondering if you think about the next 20 years, the future, what would you like to see change, especially in terms of how we support Black children and youth survivors of gender-based violence?
I mean, I would love to see organizations like Black Women in Motion, and other Black serving agencies, and organizations, grassroots organizations, have the ability to just have their own spaces and, to be able to do this work. A lot of people who are doing this work are doing it like by the skin of their teeth, by the skin of their teeth in terms of the grant writing and all of that. Just having more access to space and things like that. So to be able to do the work accordingly, do the work in the way that it's envisioned to be done. And even agencies that are not serving, specifically serving Black folks, but all agencies having a thorough support system and thorough understanding of what it looks like to support Black folks, Black youth, Black children, Black families, right? And obviously, we want to be able to do things holistically, applying transformative justice models where we can. But it's just important for us to just fully be open to seeing and believing Black youth and children when they come forward about their experiences of gender-based violence, and that corporations, organizations, community organizations, nonprofits, whatever, have progressive anti-Black racist structures in how they're able to support Black folks in their communities, whether or not there's a lot of Black folks in their community. But just having the models there.
Kaniqua Phillips, thank you so much for being here with us today, for making the time to share your experiences and insights in terms of this really important area of supporting Black youth, and in particular, Black child and youth survivors of violence. And we know that your insights will have meaning for so many others who are also working to bring about the change that you're hoping to see in 20 years or so. Hopefully soon. That would be wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. The Learning Network has been so great and has touched on so many different topics, and just and in such creative ways and such an expanse of speakers. I'm so honored to even be able to be on this podcast. So thank you, Linda, for all the work that you've been doing with having these conversations, even when they got hard. Thank you so much.
It's our honor. Please stay tuned for our next episode. And you can do that by looking out for an email from the Learning Network, to see when that episode is ready. Take care and goodbye.